This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of refusing to speak about the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara has written a memoir about leading it. McNamara was Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and was one of the principal architects of the war. Now, he says, he and his colleagues who ran the war were, quote, wrong, terribly wrong. He says he owes it to future generations to explain why. McNamara has been praised and condemned for his new memoir, which has reopened the debate on the war in Vietnam. The book, In Retrospect, will be number one on the New York Times bestseller list this Sunday. I asked Robert McNamara if he thinks of his book as an apology to the American public.
Some people have used redemption, apology, forget redemption and apology, and say that I think those of us, assuming for the minute I'm correct, as I say in the preface, I believe it was an error. A tragic error. Assume for the minute that my judgment is correct, then I think we owe an explanation to future generations of what happened and how to avoid that in the future. That's the purpose of the book.
To explain.
To explain, and more than explain, to draw lessons and suggest how to prevent similar tragedies in the future.
Do you think an apology is appropriate?
Well, if you want me to apologize, of course, but that's not the issue. The issue isn't apology. You don't I'll call it correct a wrong by apologizing. You can correct a wrong only if you understand how it occurred and you take steps to ensure it won't happen again.
In your book, you raise what you describe as a profound, enduring, and universal ethical and moral dilemma. How, in times of war and crisis, can senior government officials be completely frank to their own people without giving aid and comfort to the enemy?
I do. You're correct.
So looking back, what do you think should have been done?
Looking back, that's an easy answer. You say what should have been done. It's not going to be relate entirely to this moral dilemma, but I think serious errors were made in failing to, I'll call it, obtain the approval of the American people and their representatives in Congress to involving this nation in a land war in Asia. Now, you could say, or your audience will say, well, that's the wrong answer. The Johnson administration had the full written approval of the Congress to introduce whatever military forces it believed necessary into Asia. And that's correct on the surface. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution, passed in 1964, gave the president full authority to introduce whatever force he needed in Asia. But the Congress didn't intend at that time, and the president made clear he didn't intend at that time to use the resolution to send the forces we eventually sent. So we were wrong. We did not obtain the authority of the people and their representatives to do what we did, and that was wrong.
But the question that you raised in what I just quoted is, how do you deal with information that doesn't look good for our side when you're afraid it's going to give comfort to the enemy?
That's a very important point, and it's less important, by the way, than the one I've just made, however.
You want to pass on lessons from the Vietnam War, and this is the kind of thing that leaders are always faced with.
Let me try to again make clear. The most important issue leaders must face, and I think the one we failed on, and I hope the leaders in the future won't, is they should not take this nation to war without the support of the people and the authority of the Congress. That's the point. Now, coming to I think it's a subordinate point, assuming for the minute we're involved in war, how can one inform the American people without at the same time, I'll call it, giving aid and comfort to the enemy? And that's a very, very difficult point. But let me point out to you what isn't recognized today, that the Vietnam War was the first and only war in which the press was uncensored. The American people were getting press reports from Vietnam every day, uncensored press reports. Now, at the same time, I come back to the point you made earlier, that the representatives of the government were finding it difficult at times to be candid with the American people without giving aid and comfort to the enemy? And I don't have any good answer to that. One has to take the circumstances of the time and deal with them.
Well, a couple of things, though, about press censorship. One is it was an undeclared war. And,
well, whatever
and
it was,
also,
it was
uncensored. I think also some reporters felt that their editors were under pressure by the government.
That is totally wrong. That is totally wrong. You go back and read the press reports at the time. They were uncensored, and I'll call it unvarnished. And many, many were very critical. Although, and let me make this point now because it's a very important one. It's not recognized today that the Congress was supportive, the press was supportive, the president was, I mean, the public was supportive of American action in Vietnam. But let me finish this. But that does not relieve the leaders of the government a responsibility to lead. The leaders of our government should not be following the polls. They should not be following the press. They should be leading the nation in the direction in which the nation's interests lie. We thought we were. We weren't.
Robert McNamara is my guest. He's written a memoir called In Retrospect. You say the American public was supportive of the war. I mean, come on. Washington was just filled with demonstrations. Every college campus you went to, there were demonstrations. So maybe the polls indicated to you that there were times when a majority of Americans supported the war, but you knew very well that there was such strong dissent. And in fact, I'd like to ask you
Wait a minute. Let me comment on your question, on your statement, I should say. You're absolutely right. There were massive protests, and I've got an amusing incident if you're interested. One of the protesters, a very close friend of one of my children, and we had them for dinner. I stayed in contact with the protesters. I knew what the protesters were thinking. The majority of the people believed as we did, and we were mistaken in our judgment, and we should have led the majority of the people to a different view. We believed this nation was under serious threat of communist aggression in Asia and Western Europe, and if we lost Vietnam, in the words of Dean Rusk, we would be facing a catastrophic world war. This was the Eisenhower point in 1954 on the dominoes. That's what we believed at the time. That's what the majority of people believed. The protesters didn't. They were a very vocal minority.
Let me ask you about the anti-war movement. I think some of the conclusions that you reach in your memoir about the war, why the war was unwinnable and why it was a mistake, leaders of the peace movement were saying for many years, for example, that the communist threat wasn't as great as it was represented to be, that the North Vietnamese, even though they had a small and low-tech army, had strong nationalistic feelings and a will to keep fighting, and then that would inspire them to just keep pushing. I'm wondering if you listened to the peace movement at all, or if you shut it out and just thought, you know, they're wrong and I'm not going to pay any attention to what they're saying.
Now, I listened to the peace movement. One of the close friends of my middle child, a daughter, organized and led thousands of individuals to march on Washington, demonstrate against the president, against me. My daughter, on several occasions, brought him home to dinner after that. On one occasion, after dinner, we went into the library. We talked until 10:30. As he left, his last words, very serious, were, "No man can be all bad who loves the mountains as much as you do." I listened to the protesters. I had them in my home. So that's one point. Now, the second point, you have to understand where we came from. And many of the protesters had not. President Kennedy, Dean Rusk, and I, and many others of us, had fought in World War II. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Churchill said millions of men lost their lives in that war because the West reacted too late to Hitler's menace to the security of Western Europe. And by God, says Churchill, we should never do that again. Just after that war, the Soviet Union took control of Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia. After that, in my period, in August of 1961, the Soviet Union sought to take Berlin. General, I called Norstad, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, to my office. I asked him how we would have to react. He said, you may well have to use nuclear weapons. This was a dangerous world. A year later, Khrushchev put nuclear missiles into Cuba. To this day, the American public doesn't know how close we came to nuclear war. In June of 67, the Egyptians vowed to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. The Israelis learned of it in advance. They attacked Egypt, knocked the hell out of them, hit Jordan as well. Kosygin used the hotline for the first time, the Soviet prime minister, to Johnson, said, if you want war, you'll get it. It was a dangerous world. That was driving us to our action in Vietnam. We were wrong. The protesters turned out, with hindsight, to be right. We didn't believe it at the time.
You wrote in your memoir that one of the things that you found disturbing was that the colleges with the most prestige, the colleges with the highest educational standards, these were the colleges with the most forceful anti-war protests.
It was worse than that. Let me add on that. You haven't quoted the sentence completely. I said it wasn't only the colleges, the best colleges, I'll say, were the hotbeds of protest. It was within those colleges that, I'll call it the higher the level of education, say the graduate students versus the undergraduate, and the higher the level of intellectual achievement, those graduating with distinction and honors as compared to those graduating with normal degrees, that the degree of education, the degree of, I'll call it academic achievement, the higher it was, the greater the protest. And I drew a lesson from that. I thought, my God, these bright, educated people are opposed to our policy. We need to rethink it. And we did, but we always came up against this fear that Eisenhower in his 1954 statement might well have been correct. If we, and Dean Rusk in the statement he wrote to the president, which, by the way, is the only piece of paper that Dean Rusk sent to the president in my 7 years that I didn't see at that time. I didn't see that piece of paper until I got it declassified and started to write this book. Dean said, if we lose Vietnam, we will face a catastrophic war, World War III. Now, we were wrong. I want you to understand that. But when we had faced potential nuclear war with the Soviet Union twice in my years in the Pentagon, one had to think about it. It was a real threat. We overestimated it. We exaggerated it. And a point you made earlier, and I think it's a very important one, and it just slipped by and I didn't comment on it, but let me reemphasize it. You were right. You said that some of the protesters said, and they were right, that this was, in a sense, not a war of communist aggression. It was a civil war. Now, there was some degree of communist aggression, no question about it. But you were right, and they were right. And I think it was, I'll call it, more a civil war than it was a war of communist aggression. I make that point in the book. And let me just finish this sentence once more. We looked upon Ho Chi Minh as a follower of Stalin and Khrushchev, when what he really was, I think, with hindsight, he was an Asian Tito. He was pushing the independence of his people. Now, maybe he would have served the communist cause. He was certainly a communist. Maybe he would have served the communist cause. But the Chinese at that time were calling the U.S. paper tigers. They were saying what was happening in Vietnam was a war of liberation. They were going to extend that across the developing world. I think their words were not supported by actions. Ho Chi Minh, I believe, was a nationalist leading, in his mind, a civil war.
My guest is Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense. He's written a new memoir called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert McNamara. He was one of the architects of the war in Vietnam. You raise the question in your book, you know, why didn't you and other government officials spend more time on questions that seriously challenged some of the rationales of the war? And you write, readers of your memoir must wonder how presumably intelligent, experienced officials failed to address questions whose answers so deeply affected the lives of our citizens and the welfare of our nation. An orderly, rational approach was precluded by the crowding out, which resulted from the fact that Vietnam was but one of a multitude of problems we confronted.
Let me digress just a second to say I signed a contract to write an autobiography. And when I presented the book proposal to publishers, I outlined how I was going to do it, and I had a section on the Defense Department. I was there 7 years. Vietnam was just one of 100 problems, if you will, we were dealing with at that time. I didn't mention one, the Bay of Pigs, which occurred within 90 days after. It was a total debacle. Then we faced Berlin, and we faced Cuba, both of which we handled, I think, very, very wisely and very well. Then we faced the June 67 war. Again, I think we handled very well. But in between this, the cities were burning. We had racial problems. We had riots in the cities. And Vietnam fitted in all of this, and we did not organize properly to deal with it. I think we organized admirably to deal with the nuclear danger in the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it was a relatively simple thing to deal with it. It was a short period of time, a simple, narrow issue. We should have organized, I'll call it a war cabinet, Churchillian war cabinet, to deal with Vietnam. We didn't. That's one of the reasons we failed to address the questions you've outlined.
But Vietnam was a place where, you know, thousands and thousands of young Americans were dying. I guess it's a kind of frightening thought that you felt you were all just too busy, and that's one of the reasons why the war
No, you're conveying a misimpression. It was that, my God, we were working, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But you were too busy to see more clearly is the point you're trying to make.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we were overwhelmed with problems, and we hadn't organized to segregate out from those people to work solely on Vietnam at the upper echelons of the government. And that's one of the lessons. And in the last chapter, I point to 11 lessons, of which that's one. For God's sakes, Mr. America, when you face military conflict, organize to deal with it effectively.
I want to get back to the peace movement for a second and ask you if this kind of behavior had any effect on you. You write in your memoir about how, after speaking to students at the Harvard Business School, a group of students surrounded your car and were shaking it. And I mean, you were surrounded and felt quite under attack. You were at the Seattle airport after climbing Mount Rainier, and a man came up to you and spit on you and called you a murderer. You're at a restaurant, a woman comes up to you and calls you a baby killer. What impact did that have on you?
Well, I relate all that in the book to emphasize that there were protests. And I was aware of them, as I've just outlined. My children were of the generation that was protesting. One of them was at Stanford, for example, and was involved in the protests there. And you point to the protests at Harvard.
Focus my question a little bit more so you understand more of what I'm getting at.
No, I understand.
But allow me to just focus it a little more. I'm wondering if that kind of direct confrontation put you in a position of hardening yourself more against the protesters, whether that behavior reached you and made you think something wrong is happening here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was the latter. No, it didn't harden me. How could it harden me when I mentioned that my daughter brought protesters into the home, and when my son was associated with them in California? And as a matter of fact, I was meeting with one of the major protesters, a chaplain at Yale at the time, and I met with many others because I felt we had to stay in touch with them. And you haven't begun to deal with this issue of protest. Let me tell you something. It's in the book, and I hope your listeners will read it. A man, a Quaker, one of the finest human beings, his name was Morrison. He burned himself to death under my window in the Defense Department. And yesterday, the first point I want to make is I was aware of the way people felt. I was aware of the problem. They didn't see the danger of Soviet communist aggression leading to the world war that Dean Rusk predicted would happen if we didn't save Vietnam. But yesterday, I received from the widow of Mr. Morrison, she's now remarried, her name is Ann Morrison Welch, a letter, and I want to read one paragraph. To heal the wounds of that war, we must forgive ourselves and each other and help the people of Vietnam to rebuild their country. I am grateful to Robert McNamara for his courageous and honest reappraisal of the Vietnam War and his involvement in it. I hope his book will contribute to the healing process. She was a protester. He was a protester. She is a noble lady. She understands we should look back. In retrospect, we should draw the lessons to try to prevent that from happening again.
I guess what I think a lot of people want to know is this. During the period when you had grave doubts about the war and 1,000 Americans a month were getting killed in that war, was it hard for you to not speak out publicly? And then also after you left the administration, and the war continued for 7 more years, and American casualties continued to mount up. If you had such grave doubts, how did you not manage to share them?
You misstate my position. It wasn't that I had, I'll call it, grave doubts about the war. I had grave doubts that we could win it militarily, and that is a major distinction. At the same time I had grave doubts about winning it militarily, I, along with my associates, believed that if we didn't prevent communist domination of Vietnam and use of that to obtain communist control of Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, we would be moving to a World War III. And therefore, what I had to do was reconcile this fear that we couldn't win militarily with the fear that if we just disengaged, we'd be on the way to World War III. And the way I brought those together in these memoranda of May 67 and November 67 was to say to the president, Mr. President, I don't think we can win militarily. We've got to use our military pressure as a basis for negotiation that will permit us to disengage militarily without leaving South Vietnam to communist control and the start of World War III. That was the basis.
Let me tell you something a friend said to me when she knew I was going to interview you. She said, "Oh, I bet he wrote this book because he knows he's going to meet his maker."
Look, when I meet my maker, the book isn't, he's not going to consider the book. The book was not written for redemption. Redemption is between me and my maker, and the book will have no influence on how he responds to that.
Robert McNamara, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you indeed.
Robert McNamara's new memoir is called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.